This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today is the Friday recap where we revisit a few of the most interesting conversations we had this week. Up first, we hear from our workforce reporter in Elkhart to learn about a dispute over a worker union's giant inflatable rat. Justin's latest feature about free speech and a 12-foot-tall inflatable rat aired nationally on NPR. Welcome to the program, Justin.
Hey, Miriam. Thanks for having me.
We're going to listen to your piece in a minute, but before we do, how did you come across this story?
Yeah, so long story short, reporters, we monitor a lot of different agencies and different documents that come across our desk. And one of the agencies that I monitor is the NLRB. It's the National Labor Review Board. And I specifically kind of take a look at our regional office, which is in Indianapolis. But the regional office covers Indianapolis, parts of Illinois, a couple other little sections of other states, too. So I kind of found this because a decision was issued and it came across my desk.
Well, we're going to take a listen real quick to your story. This is the version that recently aired on NPR.
Turns out giant, grotesque rats have the right to free speech. Inflatable rats deployed by unions, that is. That's how one labor leader put it after a federal labor board recently ruled in their favor. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports, these rats are often used to signal a labor dispute.
A.C. Wurzbach and some construction workers from the Local 150 are protesting on a sidewalk in Chicago. They're flanking a 12-foot-tall inflatable rat they've nicknamed Scabby. It's got pointy teeth, red eyes, and depictions of scabs on its belly. And now it apparently has free speech rights, too. Wurzbach claims most people love this inflatable rat, though it's been run over, graffitied, and even stabbed.
One location that we were at, an irate lady came out, started stabbing it with a butcher knife. There's scars right here on the rat where it's been stitched back up to make it work again, but she was going to town, trying to kill Scabby.
Wurzbach says his union members are proud of those scars. It's why they request this beat-up inflatable, even though the union also deploys inflatable cats and pigs. No matter the character, the goal is to draw attention to a company the union has a dispute with.
It's the iconic symbol of a labor dispute. When they see the rat, without even knowing what's going on, most people understand.
But there's an important distinction. The union's dispute has nothing to do with LG Construction, the business Scabby's in front of today. A banner in front of the rat shows their dispute is with a different business called Brophy Excavation. The Local 150 wants to pressure this construction company to stop doing business with the one they're targeting. And for years, firms like this construction company have been crying foul. They say they're caught in the crossfire between the union and a totally different company. Philip Miscamara is a former member of the National Labor Relations Board, which he calls a miniature Supreme Court for labor law. He says the board had always ruled that it's fair to use Scabby just about anywhere. But then something changed.
The board a couple of months ago solicited briefs and telegraphed the possibility that the board might revisit this area and view these issues differently.
So Miscamara wrote a brief on behalf of retail businesses arguing that installing a giant inflatable rat outside their shop is unfair and scares off customers.
Whether or not you like large inflatable rats, the underlying message is there's a dispute that these people are having with the party that is directly behind the rat.
But Ed Maher with the Local 150 argues that these inflatables should be allowed to roam free under the First Amendment.
Scabby the rat has free speech rights. This is a protected symbol of free speech. Pure as that.
Now, after months of deliberation, the NLRB has sided with the union, and Scabby and his inflatable friends can be used as part of a protest wherever unions want. With a more union-friendly administration, unions hope it's the first in a series of wins for labor. Even so, the inflatable rat's fate could be appealed. And if that happens, Ed Maher says his union will be ready for the fight.
We're fighting for any worker's just most basic rights to go out and say, I've got something to say. Come listen to me. And if this big inflatable rat will encourage people to come listen to him, good.
Maher says they'll continue to deploy Scabby and other huge inflatables because they work. They help draw attention to the labor issues the union wants to focus on. For NPR News, I'm Justin Hicks.
Justin, that was such an excellent piece. And I'll say this. The first time I went to Chicago, I saw an inflatable rat. And I was like, what is going
on? They're
all
over out there.
Yeah, I was like, is there a carnival? Is there a circus? What's happening? But so let's talk about your story a little bit here. There's not really mention of Indiana, but there's a strong connection to Indiana. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, of course. So in journalism, sometimes things get cut for time. And this was one of them. The Indiana connection definitely got cut for time. So basically, just like with every legal case, you know, a lot of times if you want to test an idea or a principle, you have to have one particular instance to focus on, right? And actually, the particular instance which brought this case about had to do with Lippert components here in Elkhart. So Lippert components makes parts for RVs. It's not like, you know, the flashy parts that you recognize. It's, you know, like maybe an awning or something like that, like little pieces. And the exact same union that I featured in this story, the Local 150 out of Chicago, represents some workers who work in construction, which doesn't really have much to do with Lippert. But basically, Lippert got caught in the crosswire between this union and another company that Lippert was using. You know, I think they were renting cranes from them. It was a South Bend company that had cranes. So essentially, Lippert was not necessarily involved in the labor dispute. It was between the union and the crane company. But because Lippert did business with the crane company, the union said, why don't we pressure them to stop doing business, to talk to the crane company and say, hey, you got to do something different. Yeah, it was very interesting. It was all the particular case that was involved had to do with Indiana companies. But this is an issue that happens everywhere. It's called secondary action is the term for it. And the best metaphor that I can think of to help you understand is, you know, imagine you and your best friend get in a fight, right? And then you go to their partner and you say, hey, you should break up with your best friend there. You know, they're being a jerk. You should break up with them. And essentially, secondary action and what employers say is, whoa, wait a second, you know, I have nothing to do with this. Why are you coming to me and telling me I should essentially break off my connection to this other business? So it revolves a lot around that. And I think it's just kind of a fascinating topic.
Yeah, it is. It, especially when you think about that, it's like the secondary thing. It's not necessarily that specific company that's being targeted, but someone they're doing business with. With federal labor laws, there are certain things unions can't do to employees who are neutral. So why are they able to inflate these big rats?
Yeah, so it comes down to these two definitions. So unions, when we think of what unions do typically when they are on the streets, right, we typically think of unions striking. And that's called picketing. Like the legal term for that is picketing. And that comes from like, you know, your old 1920s, 1930s idea of like holding signs, you know, maybe some sandwich board kind of things, you know, and they're standing outside and they're saying like, no, we won't go, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's picketing. And there's another thing called bannering. And that's another legal definition. And bannering is essentially when you are not, you know, creating a lot of ruckus per se, but you're just handing out pieces of paper kind of quietly and kind of saying, hey, this is what's going on in that business. So the NLRB for a long time has basically said, since these inflatable rats have come along, they say essentially these rats are quiet. You inflate them. They sit there passively on the sidewalk. And so the NLRB has always said that these rats are basically more like bannering. It's a big inflatable banner. You can think of it that way. And it's not picketing. And the NLRB basically says for secondary employers, you're not allowed to picket because, you know, essentially saying that that goes too far. But they've said that because the rats fall under the bannering aspect, then you are able to do that. So basically what companies are saying, though, is that these rats are more than bannering. They want the NLRB to say these rats go further than just passing out information.
Well, in the piece you mentioned, the NLRB changed its mind and opened up the possibility for outlawing scabby in some situations. That's the rat. Do we know why it did that?
Yeah, so back in 2019, I believe it was, maybe 2018, but I think it was 2019, the Trump administration appointed a new general counsel to the NLRB. And the general counsel is essentially the lawyer who decides what cases the NLRB is going to hear and which cases they're not going to hear. Because remember, with all these little regional offices, most of the NLRB and labor dispute cases get solved on a very local level. So usually nothing really rises to the, you know, the level of having to go to this whole review board. So Trump appointed this general counsel to the review board who started kind of reopening cases that were already decided on a local level. And basically signaling, hey, we're going to take a closer look at some different things. And one of the cases that he reopened was this case between the union and Liberate Components that involved putting up a rat outside of an RV trade show. So it was case closed. A Trump-appointed lawyer for the NLRB opened it. Since then, Biden has actually summarily fired that lawyer. It was one of the first things he did when he came into office. And there's actually some contention, by the way, as to whether Biden could legally do that. So that's still kind of working its way in a totally separate court. But that's essentially what it was. It was kind of a Trump administration effort, if you will, to kind of go after Scabby. At least that's how it was interpreted.
So it's kind of like a blip in the timeline of this rat.
Exactly. Yeah. And this is not the first time this rat has gone all the way to the review board, the National Labor Review Board. Ever since, you know, the 90s and the early 2000s, when this rat started, you know, becoming used more and more often, it's been constantly reviewed by this board. And they constantly keep saying the rat is bannering. The rat can be used on secondary employers. But this Trump administration lawyer wanted to revisit that.
And what is the outcome for labor unions with all of this?
Yeah, so labor unions obviously see this as a win. They would love to, and I don't want to generalize here, but, you know, they see this as a form of protest, as a form of free speech. And they see this as, you know, if I'm advocating for the rights of workers here, you know, whatever strategy we're using, as long as it gets the desired effect, which is, you know, keeping workplaces safer or getting people better pay or better benefits or better, you know, union contracts. As long as it's in service of that, we feel like we should be able to do whatever we need to. So obviously unions like this. They like the fact that Scabby can go anywhere he wants, essentially. And they also see it as kind of a sign of support and maybe hopefully one of the first of many wins that they hope will happen in the Biden administration. Of course, the big win that they're really looking for now, and this is important to know, is the PRO Act, which is, you know, might be heard in Congress. And the PRO Act's important, actually, because the PRO Act would actually remove all sort of prohibitions on what you can do against these neutral employers. So the PRO Act would actually change a lot of this.
Thank you so much. Justin Hicks is our workforce reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting based in Elkhart. Coming up, we're going to hear from a health researcher and learn more about health research, how it was conducted during the pandemic, and what we can learn so far from the research gathered. If you have any questions or comments, you can always reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. And it's the Friday recap where we revisit a few conversations we had over the last week. Our next segment, we find out what conducting health research is like and how the pandemic has had an impact. We're joined now by Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Welcome, Dr. Nephew. It's great to have you back with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You are a physician and a researcher, and so I guess one of the big questions is, how do you balance those two roles?
Well, it could be challenging, but I love wearing both hats. As a physician, I get to see patients, to meet them, to help diagnose their problems. I get to know their families. I get to know them over long periods of time and to see them improve. And then as a scientist, I get to think about problems that may be helping or hindering them from achieving the best care if they can and how we might be able to solve those problems. So even though they're two separate hats, they work hand in hand. As a physician, I want to treat the individual patient. And as a scientist, I want to try to help figure out how I can treat a broader population of patients who may have the similar, who may have similar issues. And so they work together, being a physician and a scientist.
And you're also a KL2 scholar. Can you tell us what that means?
Sure. So, you know, when you're trying to solve problems and do research studies, it really takes finances, it takes support, it takes mentorship, it takes an infrastructure. And so being a KL2 scholar means that I submitted a proposal to the Clinical and Translational Science Institute of Indiana, and they reviewed it and they said, this sounds like a good idea. It sounds like this is something that's going to advance the health of people in our state. And it seems that she has good support and that she may actually be able to achieve these goals. And we're going to support her and help her do that. And so as a KL2 scholar, you get the support of the Clinical and Translational Science Institute, the infrastructure and all different groups and people that they have to help you to achieve kind of your research aims. You get some finances because research is expensive. You get mentorship. You get peer mentorship because as a KL2 scholar, there are also other KL2 scholars who are similarly doing research projects in other areas. So you get to learn from those scholars. So it's a great opportunity to really help advance a research project for early career investigator like myself.
That's awesome. And so what is your focus in your practice, what you do day to day? And then is that the same as the research that you do? Is it tied to what you're doing?
Yeah, they are tied. So as a physician, I see patients who have liver disease. And so people who have fatty liver disease, alcohol-associated liver disease, hepatitis C, conditions like these, I see those patients in my clinic, and I see those patients really at the end of their kind of course with disease as well when they might need transplant. So I'm a transplant hepatologist, which just means that I see patients who might need transplant. Many of my patients often ask me if I'm a surgeon. I'm not a surgeon, but I do help to figure out who needs a transplant, when they might need it, and to help get them to transplant. And similarly, as a scientist, I study barriers and access to care for vulnerable populations. So populations that may have a hard time navigating care. Often that can be in liver disease. It can be women. It can be racial and ethnic minorities. It can be the underinsured. And so I'm interested in studying how can we make accessing care, getting through the transplant process, getting treatment for liver cancer, getting treatment for hepatitis C. How can we make that easier? How can we lower the barrier so that everyone is achieving equitable care?
And what was it that led you to go down this path? I mean, it seems pretty specific, the kind of work that you're doing. Was there anything that just piqued your interest that got you involved?
I think just seeing health inequity all around. I think I study a very kind of specific disease, right? So I study liver cancer and hepatitis C. But really, if you're looking at barriers to care, these things can be seen in all types of areas of care. So diabetes and hypertension. And if you're a healthcare provider and you're taking care of patients, time and time again, you say, wow, I wish that I could give this patient this, but they don't have enough insurance. I wish that I could help this patient get this treatment, but I don't think it was explained to them very well. And maybe we didn't communicate it effectively. And there's some issues with health knowledge and health literacy. So I think as a physician, even as a medical student, you quickly see that there are a number of barriers to people's care. And if you could just do something about it. And so I think I began to see those barriers to care early on and really wanted to do something about the social needs and structural determinants of health that I think make it difficult for people to access care.
And you mentioned health literacy and health knowledge. Would you say that for the most part, the public isn't really health literate, or is it just dependent upon, I guess, whether people are having access to health in general?
I think that there are kind of two separate issues, and there's difficulty with both. I think that people struggle with health-related knowledge, and part of that is because physicians aren't always great at communicating effectively in a way that people can understand. And so when a patient walks away from a visit and they don't understand why they saw me, what treatment they are supposed to be considering, I consider that, you know, onus to be on us. And so, yes, I think there are lots of issues with health-related knowledge, but I think we are learning how to be better at physicians at communicating with patients effectively. And then access is different because there's some people who have really great health knowledge and can communicate very effectively with their physicians, but still have difficulty accessing care just because it can be difficult from an insurance standpoint. And some people have multiple providers for many different conditions, and it's hard even for a very savvy person to be able to navigate that system. So I think there are issues with health knowledge and literacy. There are issues with access. There can be separate, and they can both exist or they can exist independently. And I think as physicians, we're trying to do better at communicating effectively so that patients can understand exactly what's going on so they can make informed decisions.
Well, if you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Dr. Lauren Nephew, Assistant Professor of Medicine in the Division of Gastroenterology and Hepatology at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Dr. Nephew, I wonder, if, for folks that might have some health literacy or seem to be understanding what's going on, do you think that the internet creates problems like when patients come in and say, well, I read on Google, blah, blah, blah?
It can. I think I'm excited. So I won't say I'm excited. I am happy to hear when a patient is interested in figuring out what's going on with them. That makes me know that they are active in their care, they are engaged, they are involved, they really want to know, why is this happening to me? So I take that as an opportunity. I said, this is a person who really wants to learn. And then I try to redirect if there's been misinformation that's been gathered. The internet is just full of information. It's really hard to know what's accurate, what's inaccurate. So I wouldn't say that the internet has been a hindrance to the doctor-patient relationship per se, but I think it's an opportunity for me to redirect patients, to provide the right information. It lets me know that they're really engaged. They really want to know what's going on. It can require some redirection, but I'm okay with that.
Well, I'm glad to hear your viewpoint on that because I'm one of those Googlers sometimes.
I'm like, I think a lot of people are.
Yeah. I mean, but we have to be careful, obviously, about the sources. And, you know, I try to stick to things like Mayo Clinic or whatever, versus these random medical websites. But the research that you've been working on, what is some of the stuff that you've done recently?
Well, right now I'm trying to understand barriers in care for patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, which is liver cancer. And so I'm trying to understand what social determinants and what social needs might impede people from accessing liver cancer care. Liver cancer is complex because people have not only cancer, but they have cirrhosis. So they have two very challenging diagnoses. And then on top of that, patients may also bring different social needs and social determinants to the table that can make it challenging for them to understand all of their different referrals, all of their different providers, all this complex information about radiation, chemotherapy, transplant. And so recently, we're trying to understand exactly what social needs do people have. Are they associated with poor health outcomes when people have a lot of unmet social needs? And then are there social needs that we might be able to mitigate from inside the healthcare system? Certainly, we can't put money in people's pockets, but can we help lower the barriers to care? Can we link people with social workers? Can we give them more health related information at a level that they can understand? Can we communicate more effectively? And so we're trying to understand which are the barriers or which social needs are most important and which ones can we effectively act on from inside the healthcare system.
And is this research still ongoing or were you able to find some results?
It's still ongoing. What we have found is that health literacy is a big issue in our liver patient population, and that on many health literacy studies, about 60 to 70% of people have difficulty with health-related literacy and health-related knowledge. And so it makes it really hard to effectively navigate a complex system if your health literacy is low. And so knowing that, we know that we need to be much more committed to and providing information at multiple different places in their pathway of care where they can learn about their disease and so that they can make effective choices. A lot of times people are labeled as non-compliant or not interested in care when they really just don't understand exactly what's been offered to them and what the risk benefits are of those treatments. And so Now we're working on a kind of knowledge tool to help patients to better understand hepatocellular carcinoma and all the different treatment options that are available for them in a way that kind of meets them where they are.
Did you find at all that there were generational differences in health literacy? For example, maybe older generations not engaged as much because maybe back in the day they weren't given that much information?
That's an interesting question. I actually haven't looked at our data by age group. Liver cancer usually affects people who are over 50, but we probably do have some younger people in our cohort, and that would be interesting to look at. I think what we do know is how we give health information differs by age cohort. And so while you might be able to give a tablet to a younger group of patients and they might be able to kind of look at that tablet and navigate some type of tablet-based educational programming, that might not be the best way to meet our 65 plus. They may prefer an in-person kind of teaching session, more traditional with a coordinator to help them walk through it as opposed to maybe a tablet-based intervention. So we do know we have to meet our patients at different places depending on their both birth cohort and their experience with technology.
Is that one of the biggest challenges that you face doing this research, or is there something else that would also be challenging?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. I think I think it's challenging to convince people that you can mitigate or act on social needs from in the healthcare system. Traditionally, physicians have thought that social needs and social determinants should be left to policy people. And then if we can expand Medicaid, if we can do different things from a policy level, then there's nothing really a doctor can do about your social needs. So I think one barrier is just convincing folks that just like hypertension, just like obesity, you need to identify social needs as a risk factor for disease. And convincing folks that perhaps you can do something about it, that we are equipped to do something about it, and that if we are going to get rid of health disparities and make healthcare equitable, yes, we've got to come up with really exciting novel vaccines and medications, but if you can't get people to take them, we already see what happens, right?
Right.
So you've got to be able to explain things and get people to uptake things and get people to get there, and having all the great treatments doesn't help if you can't help people to receive them. So I think there's, you know, just convincing folks that it can be done and then figuring out what cost-effective strategies can be implemented from within the healthcare system are the biggest challenges for those of us who study social determinants and social needs right now.
Well, when it comes to disparities in health equity, and I'm thinking about, for example, clinical trials that are done, do they accurately represent the population?
Well, that's been a struggle. So for decades, we've seen clinical trials not be fully representative of minorities and women. There's been efforts made to try to increase attention in that area, to try to get investigators to understand that it's important for our results to be generalizable, for them to look like there are study populations to look like the general population. I think I was very optimistic when I saw the vaccine studies because those are some of the most representative cohorts we've seen in large clinical trials, with upwards of 10% of African-American participant enrollment and even higher in Latinx populations. And so for me, that showed me that this can be done, that clinical trial studies can look more like the general population when there's really an impetus. I think Moderna, Pfizer, they knew that if we were going to get significant uptake of these vaccines, that they would have to have a study population that represented the U.S. population. And so they set out to do that, making enrollment sites in urban communities, having weekend and evening enrollments, collaborating with community organizations and doing what had to be done. So I think it can be done if it's made a priority.
Right. And I think that's the key word, the priority. I think, you know, for so long, it's just the systemic inequities that have been in place that created some of this, which makes me wonder, you know, you mentioned that women and minorities are not represented really well in clinical trials. And I don't know if this is accurate, but I've heard like even medications that you might take, the dosages are for like a typical, I don't know, 30-year-old white male, and then you're a female, and your dosage shouldn't be the same. Is that fair to say?
Well, it's complicated. I would say mm-hmm. that, you know, with many medicines, your gender may not matter for the dose. It may be more your size, and so there's certainly small men, but I think that these are questions that are unanswered. I think there's probably complex interactions that happen based on gender, some based on race and different people's exposure because of their race that we're missing. And so I don't think that medicines are currently dangerous for men, for women or for minorities because clinical trials have not had adequate enrollment. But I do think that there are nuances to medicines, how they act, what populations they may act best in that may be missing because these populations have not been very diverse.
Well, before we wrap up, what can researchers do to improve the diversity in their studies?
It's challenging. I think it's challenging mostly because it's costly. Because really, if you're going to improve diversity in your trials, then you have to think about, okay, how many study visits do I have? Are these happening during times when people work? Can people afford to take time off work? If they can't, can I reimburse them for that? Can we have weekend hours, evening hours? For our Latinx populations, can we have translators? Have these documents been translated into Spanish? What are my exclusion criteria? Are we excluding people with comorbidity because we want to have a very safe and perfect trial? But does that make us therefore exclude many minority populations that may have diabetes and chronic kidney disease? Have I explained the trial adequately to my minority patients, or am I afraid that they're going to say no, so I don't really push in a way that I might for other folks? So I think there's things that could be done.
This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, it's the Friday Recap, where we look back at some of our favorite conversations we had this past week. Coming up, we're going to hear from a couple leading a music school in Indianapolis and hear about how they were able to create music and bands during the pandemic. We're joined now by Rocky Nash and Preston Nash, the founders of Rock Garage in Indianapolis. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi.
Rocky, what is Rock Garage?
It is a music school where we really are centered around a rock band performance program where we put bands together, and it doesn't have to be rock. We cover many genres of music, but we put bands together and we go out and we perform all over the region. Actually, we played the Vogue, we played the Flyover in Anderson. We did the main stage at provided all the entertainment for the main stage at Carb Day this year. We're going to do the Mutt Strut at the end of October, Arts Fest coming up here pretty soon. But we also offer private lessons on guitar, bass, drums, ukulele, mandolin, banjo, voice, like your basic band performance instruments.
That doesn't sound basic to me as someone who can barely play guitar.
Well, we have lessons.
Well, how did this start, Rocky?
Well, we decided that we wanted to have a music school, basically. A long time ago, we were on a road trip, and Preston was a touring musician at that point. And he said, if we had stupid rock star money, what would you want to do? And we agreed that we wanted to open a music school. Now, this was decades ago. And then we were able to implement part of that dream at a local music retailer here. And we're very grateful for that. Then the pandemic hit. And the learning center at the retailer was, like everything else, was shut down. And as you can imagine, slow to reopen, like most educational facilities were. And we had the opportunity to partner with some other couples and open our own school. And now we have Rock Garage.
Preston, what was it like for you to start this endeavor, being hit by the pandemic and then starting your own thing?
It was a little frightening. You know, the one thing about when we were running it out of another retailer was, you know, a little bit of what we consider job security. And then once the pandemic hit and we were furloughed and such, we realized that that was no longer really a reality. So, it's scary going out on your own, doing your own business, but even scarier doing during, you know, a little global pandemic. It kind of makes things more complicated. We had such an outpouring of reaction from folks that were in the program before that wanted to continue. They wanted to play. They wanted some sense of normalcy that pretty much right out the gate, we were doing pretty well in terms of the amount of students that we had. So some of that scariness went away kind of quickly once we realized that it seemed like we were going to be okay.
It also feels like during the pandemic, a lot of folks picked up hobbies or things that they always really wanted to do. Would you say that you noticed a lot more people getting into musical instruments and learning how to play them?
Without a doubt. I mean, if you looked at trends, sales of instruments went up, sales of home recording equipment went up because people had more time on their hands being stuck at home. So a lot of folks did start picking up instruments that they didn't do before, kind of like this was their excuse to scratch something off a bucket list. So we did get some new folks that we didn't have in before. In fact, I don't know, maybe half of our enrollment now are probably new folks. So it's been fascinating to see on a bunch of different levels, both from a business level and also just a societal level, how this pandemic affected different people. And but luckily for us, there was enough passion for music and doing that you know, people wanted to come out and they wanted to do it. And you know, we made sure right out the gate that, you know, we followed every precaution and every recommendation from the CDC and local guidelines in terms of how to handle, you know, cleaning and face masks and distancing and so on. So we made it as safe as an environment as we could. And that also, I think, made our folks feel comfortable knowing that we were doing everything that we could to keep them safe.
Rocky, what was the most challenging part of transitioning to this new format during the pandemic? Did you have to do a lot of stuff online?
We started doing Rock Garages, just online lessons only, because again, that was when everything was shut down. And there was really nowhere else to do it. And then the outpouring of interest, as you guys were talking about, was just so overwhelming. And luckily just the universe aligned for us and we gained access to a giant warehouse, just an empty 7,000 square foot space where we could go and have the social distancing, you know, masks and all that business, where we could conduct in-person lessons, even though they're 6 or more feet away. We could have bands perform 6 or more feet away, among the bandmates. And do parking lot shows. Our student base, our membership, they were so dying to play music together again, that a lot of us were going out and doing shows in people's driveways, in cul-de-sacs, entertaining neighborhoods, again, maintaining that safe distance, but being able to play, because you don't have to be right up on top of each other to play. And it was incredible. So when we had access to that warehouse, it started to fill. And our roster filled up. And then once we gained access to our more permanent location here in Castleton, then, you know, we had our membership base and it's just grown from there.
I like that you mentioned the parking lot shows, because I think that's something that was, to me, was really cool to see during the pandemic, these just new innovative ways to do things and entertainment. And I'm going to be kind of sad to see that kind of stuff go.
Oh, it's not going to go. In fact, we have one at the end of August, on August 29th, in our parking lot.
Oh, well, that's awesome to know about. Thank you so much for sharing that. I'll definitely have to try to drive by. When it comes to teaching lessons online versus in person, Preston, what was that like for you? Is there a difference?
As a drum teacher, definitely. You know, I think with, you know, guitar where you can control the volume, you know, with a volume knob or whatever. But when you're dealing with a drum set, there's really no volume knob on a drum set. So it's kind of hard to hold a lesson very effectively with just doing it online. The connection will lag a little bit. So if you want to play along with the student to demonstrate something, that's kind of impossible. Drums are a full body instrument. So I need to see things like their posture, their feet, really how they're holding the sticks, because all of that is important as well. So for drums, it was very, very challenging. And quite frankly, I didn't enjoy it nearly as much as I enjoy doing in-person lessons. For guitar and bass and voice, it seems a little easier. And we still do offer online lessons. And our guitar teacher and our banjo teacher still conduct them regularly. So there is something to be said for being in a room with someone where you can really kind of see everything that they're doing, because so much of learning a musical instrument is mechanically inclined in terms of, you know, what their hands are doing, what their, you know, arms are positioned like. And some of that you can't really get the full picture just doing a virtual lesson over your smartphone or even a laptop.
And did you find that you were able to find new ways to accommodate for that, or was it still pretty tough?
You know, again, with drums, not to get too inside baseball, but, you know, I would do as much as I could, like with a practice pad, which is basically a slab of rubber on a piece of wood where the volume isn't that loud. But again, you know, a lot of times with the, you know, if there was like a lag in the signal or something where it wasn't like real time, it just made it a little bit more difficult. But like anything else, you adapt and you survive and you make the best of the situation. And, you know, for a couple months, that was the only choice that I had. So made the best of it and tried to do the best thing that I could for my students and servicing them the only way that I could.
Rocky, we were talking sort of about challenges, but there were also, I think, positive outcomes for folks where they were able to try new things or pivot in ways with their businesses or careers. What did you find maybe a positive or a silver lining to all of this?
Well, one of the wonderful things about this is while we were still operating primarily online, Preston and various other members of Rock Garage started sharing, like Preston would lay down like a drum track and then somebody else would lay down down guitars, or several people would lay down different kind of treatments of guitars. So like one would make it a rock song and one would make it kind of like a surfy kind of vibe song over the same drum tracks. And then a vocalist would write lyrics and lay down a melody over the top, and then somebody would pick up a bass. And so a lot of different songs, great songs have come out of this, originals. And along with that, we have some new bands, people who had never played together before in person, started writing and performing, I guess, quote unquote, virtually together. And now they go out and they play with us, they play, they do their own gigs, they do all kinds of stuff. So a lot of great music came out of it. And a lot of really cool bands and groups also came out of it as well.
Yeah, I was just home. I was, you know, there's only so much vacuuming and house chores you can do. So I was getting bored. And I was like, well, let me do something. I put out these what I called Preston play-alongs, where I record like 60 or 90 seconds of drums and, you know, post them online and invite people to write something to it. And as Rocky said, you know, a bunch of people did. They would take the same drum track and one made it a heavy metal song and the other one made it almost like a country rockabilly thing. And so that's an idea that I'm actually going to relaunch again. You know, when things settle down a little bit here, you know, running a new business. But there were some creative outlets, you know, again, necessity is the mother of invention. So there were some creative things that came out of necessity of trying to express oneself as a musician in a time when that was really the last thing that you could do.
I wonder too if it allowed more folks in music and musicians such as yourself to play around with technology and different things that are out there.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know just several people. I mean, they're ordering different pedals, they're ordering different things to affect their instruments, their voices completely differently, and mess around, maybe dial in their amp or their pedal board in a way that they hadn't been able to program before. So because we all had time on our hands if we weren't working in a
quote unquote essential job.
Yeah, essential job. So yeah, absolutely. People were messing around with a lot more, and especially writing. I mean, it's cathartic. I mean, they were, you know, getting out their frustration, getting out their emotion about, you know, anything they were reflecting upon, of course. I mean, like I said, several great songs came out of it, and a lot of really cool groups and bands also came out of it as well.
Well, I can tell you're both really passionate about what you do and about the music. What got you started in music, if you don't mind my asking?
I got started, you know, as a kid, basically. And, you know, it started with a snare drum at Christmas when I was like six. That broke in about 3 days, and the bug never left me. And then, you know, as a teenager, not even a teenager, you know, like around 10, 11, I discovered bands like Kiss and Cheap Trick and Van Halen. I was like, as soon as that's why I still have a soft spot for Kiss. It's like, that was the group that made me say, all right, this is all I want to do for the rest of my life. And pretty much since then, that's all I wanted to do for the rest of my life. And so I pursued it, you know, went the route that a lot of people do. You know, you take some lessons, you form a garage band, you play your, you know, shows around your town with people that you know. And I eventually went on to school to, you know, get some degrees in music as well. And to really kind of ensure that even if I did get to the point where, you know, I achieved some goals that I wanted to, you know, the record deal and touring and making albums and such, like I was lucky enough to be able to do, with the thought that, all right, well, that may not last forever. And it didn't. And, you know, I still wanted to make music my life. So that's why I always went to school to get some, I guess, proper formal training and degrees. So this was really all I ever wanted to do with my life. So it started with a snare drum at Christmas and Kiss for me.
For me, I mean, I always had, my grandparents always had music playing in their house. And my dad did too. He played in local bands. And but aside from like swing choir in school and stuff like that, I went the radio route. Actually, I was in radio and TV for several years. And so that was my musical outlet until Preston. My sister was getting married and she wanted us to write her a song, and we were going to record it, and Preston was going to have somebody else sing it. And I was like, nope, it's my sister. I'm going to grow the spine and sing it myself. And then after that recording, Preston was like, you just want to start a band? And we did. And that was 17 years ago.
Is there anything that we can look forward to for Rock Garage?
Well, we always keep our show calendar full, and you can catch all of our upcoming shows at rockgaragemusic.com. That's our website, rockgaragemusic.com. And if you are interested in private lessons or our band program, that's also the place to contact us. The live shows is always a big part of what our program is about. We just acquired a recording console that used to belong to Kenny Rogers, keyboard player. And so right now we are working on building up our recording studio. So we're going to be open for recording to the public as well soon, and offering recording classes. So we're always trying to keep up with just the full roster of musicians and bands that we have. We are still looking for new ways to grow and expand and offer more services to the musicians of Indianapolis and through virtual things beyond. So,
all right. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time today. Rocky Nash and Preston Nash are the founders of Rock Garage in Indianapolis. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yasin. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.